قال امیر المؤمنین علی علیه السلام زکات العلم نشر.
سبحان الله حمدا لله ولا اله الا
الله.
تصیبش چجوری در حضرت فرید
اینجوری اینجا از آقای اسلامی هستن و آقای علیزاده هستن و خانم حکیمی هستن.
اعوذ بالله من الشیطان الرجیم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة على محمد وعلى الطاهرين.
اللهم
Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to our second autumn school. We are going to talk about some aspects of Allama Bahauddin Yazdi, but first of all, I'd like to draw your attention to a verse from the Quran, and we are going to take it from this verse. And also, well, we will be discussing about, you know, some points that might be, you know, neglected or ignored in the previous session. First, I'd like to start with Surah Al-Hamd. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Maliki Yawm al-Din. إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين. Please recite another salawat. Well, there is an ayah in Surah Mujadilah, this is verse number 11, in which Allah the Almighty says, أَوْضِ اللَّهِ الشَّيْطَانُ الرَّجِيمِ يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا إِذَا قِيلَ لَكُمْ تَفَسَّحُوا فِي الْمَجَالِسِ فَفْسَحُوا يَفْسَحِ اللَّهُ لَكُمْ وَإِذَا قِيلَ انْشُزُوا فَانْشُزُوا يَرْفَعِ اللَّهُ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا مِنْكُمْ وَالَّذِينَ أُوتُوا الْعِلْمَ دَرَجَاتٍ وَاللَّهُ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ خَبِيرٌ. When it is said to you, make room in your assemblies, then make ample room, Allah will give you ample. And when it is said, rise up, then rise up, Allah will exalt those of you who believe and those who are given knowledge in high degrees, and Allah is aware of what you do. So, let's start with our discussion. We are in the presence of some of the scholars, masters from different, you know, school, different institutions. We are in the presence of first of all Dr. Muhammad Taghi Islami, the faculty member of the Islamic Science and Culture Academy, and also we have Dr. Sayyid Muhammad Ali Zadeh Mousavi, and he is also from the same academy, I mean the faculty member of the Islamic Science and Culture Academy. And also we are in the presence of another doctor. She is Dr. Mohammadi Kia. She is a faculty member of the Institute for Humanities and Cultural Studies. And the topics will be, number one, Dr. Islam will talk about this matter. I mean, how Muslim philosophers derive ethical proofs as seen in the academic works and moral conduct of Ayatollah Allama Bahauddin Yazdi. And second, we will go and shift to Dr. Sayyid Ali Zadeh Mousavi, and the topic is the Quran is the exegetical method of Allama Bahauddin Yazdi. And at the end, we will be discussing and we're talking about the topic of Dr. Muhammad Ikiya, and that is Allama Bahauddin's comprehensive understanding of the intellectual and transmitted sciences. So we will start and, you know, go one by one to talk about these points. And if there's anything if there is a question, because this session is going to be held in person and online. So if there is any question in comments, you can send your notes. And we are in the presence of doctors. We ask them about, you know, the points, if there are something missed or misunderstood. And first of all, I'd like to ask Dr. Muhammad Taghi Islam to start his discussion, and we'll take benefit from the points that he's going to explain and go to details. Because in the first session we discussed also aspects of Adnan Bahawad, yes, but right now we are going to go to details and to know more about this, you know, points that might be neglected. So we'll start with Dr. Islami after saying Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Thank you brothers and sisters all present here and audiences from out of the place. My presentation is about the stylistics of ethical justification and moral reasoning from the viewpoint of Hakim Bahabadi of Yazdi. I prepared some essay in five parts, and I shall read it on the topic and on the I've read my essay, and after my reading, if there is any question, I will be prepared to answer them if I can. The stylistics of ethical justification and moral reasoning from the viewpoint of Hakim Bahabadi of Yazdi. Number one, today applied ethicists introduced three methods of justification and reasoning to prove moral judgment: the top-down method, the bottom-up method, and the reflective equilibrium method. The top-down method is a logical deductive method. Deduction is the same method used in the mathematical sciences. In the deductive method, certain propositions contain premises. In this method, moral theories are expected to play the role of certain premises to prove moral judgments. But none of the moral theories can provide a certain predetermined structure to prove any moral judgment. A structure that can act like a mathematical rule in ethics and be equally applicable to all cases. The first problem with moral theories is that they are abstract and cannot cover all the objective and concrete details in a moral event. This problem has led many researchers in applied ethics to abandon the reference to ethical theories and to adopt an anti-theoretical approach and to turn to the bottom-up method. Now, the bottom-up method is a logical inductive method. Logical inductive method is the same method used in experimental science. Inductive reasoning consists of empirical premises, and its result is not certain. This method does not refer to a predetermined theory or theoretical structure. Also, this method is completely based on the results obtained from the study of cases and the verdict obtained as a result is completely partial, and the verdict of each case is different from another case. It is clear that if there is no previous theoretical structure to evaluate and measure the judgment of cases, and if the judgment of each case is completely subject to the conditions and contextual characteristics of each case, then we will never have an absolute moral judgment. And morality will always be relative. So the bottom-up method leads us to the moral relativism. Moral relativism, as you know, is a theory that has many problems. Thus, the bottom-up, the top-down suffers. The top-down method suffers from forms of abstraction, and the bottom-up method confronts us with moral relativism. What can we do, and what method to use? Is there a third way? Here, thinkers have invented a third method that thinks about the doubtful balance between high and low. That is, it thinks about multiplying the results of paying attention to moral theories according to the conditions and background characteristics of each specific case. This method is called moral principialism. Number two, all moral principialists consider existing moral theories to be too abstract and therefore unworthy of certain importance, central importance in moral reasoning. But none of them avoid these theories altogether. Some try to provide a correct interpretation of the ontological or consequentialist theories, and some find it useful to combine and complement different theories. The result of this interpretation or combination is the integration and complement and compilation of moral principles. These principles, rather than moral theories, are the cornerstone of moral reasoning. Principles such as charity, beneficence, and justice. Number three, about the justification basis of moral principles, a group of principalists justify moral principles based on human reasons, reason and nature. This group pays little attention to the role of history, social contract, tradition, customs, and the like in justifying moral principles. But another group of principalists consider the basis of the justification of moral principles to be common morality, which pays basic attention to the role of history, social contract, tradition, customs, and the like. Now the question arises, where did we get these moral principles? To answer this question, we inevitably enter into meta-ethical discussions about the meaning and justification of moral propositions. Philosophers such as William Rankina, in the theorizing of normative ethics, ultimately proved that their unbiased attempt to arrive at a relatively stable theory does not come to an end. In fact, this group provides the basis for the hypothesis that even if moral propositions tells about a reality, this reality is not a merely descriptive reality that can be obtained in the form of descriptive theories. Rather, the recommending or guiding element in these propositions, I mean moral propositions, plays a central and consistent role. If this hypothesis is proved, it turns out that the reasoning process for justifying moral propositions is fundamentally different from the reasoning process in other sciences. Here, we are dealing with a different kind of reasoning. If one base of this reasoning is based on a descriptive fact and indicates what is, the other base must be based on the recommending fact and indicates what ought to be. There is no logically productive relationship between descriptive facts and moral do's and don'ts, between is and ought. There is a morally fallacy that is famous, that called is-out problem in ethics. Although we should not deny that other kinds of logical relations are in the place. Number four, Western moral philosophy and applied ethics texts, as the author has researched, as I researched, have not addressed the question of the nature of such reasoning. However, Muslim sages and logicians, where they have discussed in detail the types of logical reasoning, have considered moral propositions such as the commonly accepted ones. That constitute the premise of polemical reasoning. Polemical reasoning is reasoning based on facts or statements which are intended to oblige or inform the opponent. It should be noted that polemical reasoning is not a fallacy, even if it is not an argument based on certainty. Even if it's not Burhan, it's not a fallacy. There has been a discussion among Muslim scholars about the evidential nature of moral issues, and some of them have believed that moral issues have not certain evidences, but rather they have special commonly accepted ones. Mashhurat khasse. Perhaps it can be assumed that the doubt of how to solve moral problems, as well as the challenges and deadlocks that existed in explaining and clarifying moral propositions based on general and total theories, led these scholars to disbelieve. Anyway, those who consider moral issues to have commonly accepted reasoning can show interest in case studies and contextualized approaches, while those who believe in the evidential nature of moral issues, if they do not reject case studies and contextualism, will at least look at them with caution. Following the thought of Muslim scholars who have considered moral rules not from proofs, but from common knowledge, leads us to believe that their position is in fact in line with the answer to the question of the meaning and justification of moral propositions and rules, which is considered a meta-ethical discussion. In the meta-ethical discussion area, the theory of moderate moral recommendation is very close to the theory of these Muslim scholars. Although the discussion of applied ethics methods is in the field of normative ethics, not meta-ethics, it is necessary to discuss the meta-ethical principles that govern these methods. Adopting a recommendatory basis aligned with popular knowledge of ethical issues strengthens the evidence base for the use of case studies and reflective equilibrium, as Jarvals called it. Number 5. Muslim scholars often consider moral propositions to be special, and in this way they consider moral reasoning not in the line of argumentative arguments, but in the line of polemical arguments. These points is reflected in the logical works of the sages, especially in the topic of Sana'at Khams, which is devoted to the methodology of various types of logical arguments. It is surprising that this very important topic was neglected by the late logicians, and according to Hakim Bahawadi in his comments on the book of Tahzib al-Mantiq, the expression of the late scholars on this topic was infected by a disturbing brevity. This brevity and the neglect of accurate and precise elaboration have become an excuse for critics who have not made sufficient efforts to understand this topic and have criticized the sages and logicians that the style of moral reasoning they have considered leads ethics to the abyss of relativism. While this criticism is not correct, and we can inspire by the hints of sages such as Hakim Bahawadi, uncover the ambiguity of the stylistics of moral reasoning desired by Muslim sages and reveal the conclusion that the popularization of moral proposition not only has nothing to do with moral relativism, but it is in harmony with the reality of man's moral life. The discovery of this harmony and its application has brought fruitful results in the practical life and moral conduct of sages whose lives we have in the biographies of Islamic scholars. Hakim Murda Abdullah Bahawadi of Yazdi is one of these leaders of these sages. Thank you for it.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your very informative points that you mentioned here. Right now we are going to shift to thank you very much for your informative points and topics in this session. We are going to shift to Dr. Sayyid Hamid Adizadeh Mousavi, and the topic is the Quranic exegetical method of Allama Bahawadi Yazdi. We are going to take benefit from the points he's going to mention here and get ready for the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, dear brothers and sisters, and also thank you, dear Professor Islami, for your informative lectures regarding the Allama Bahawadi, and thank you, dear Dr. Akhipur, for arranging this meeting. And alhamdulillah, this is very precious work that you do for Allama Bahawadi. I hope, inshallah, this series of meeting gives us a very informative information about these ulama and these scholars in Islam. So, my topic is the brother Mr. Ramadan Farid, Ramadan Farid said, is about the manhaj or the method of Allama Bahabadi's interpretations and the commentary on the Quran. And for reaching to understand what is the method of Allama Bahabadi in commentary of the Quran and the interpretation of the Quran, we have to know what is these methods and these tendencies, what are the methods and tendencies in the interpretation of the Quran. As you know, the interpretation of the Quran and the commentary on the Quran is started from the beginning of Islam and the revelation of the Quran. So the first interpreter of the Quran is the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And we have this fact in the Quran, in these many verses of the Quran. For example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَأَنْزَلْنَا إِلَيْكَ الذِّكْرَ لِتُبَيِّنَ لِلنَّاسِ لِتُبَيِّنَ here means interpretation, تبين, explanation, clarification. So, تُبَيِّنَ is the command, the interpretation of the Quran. So the first exegete and the first commentator of the Quran is the Prophet. Also in the chapter Jum'ah, in Surah Jum'ah, the verse, the second verse, we see يَتْلُوا عَلَيْهِمْ آيَاتِهِ وَيُذَكِّيهِمْ وَيُعَلِّمُهُ الْكِتَابِ يُعَلِّم, here also is the interpretation. The second, we can say, interpreter of the Quran are the Ahlul Bayt, the infallible Imams. So we have also many verses in the Quran who are indicates this fact. For example, وَلَا يَمَسُهُ إِلَّا الْمُطَحَرُونَ who are the Mutahharun, are the infallible Imams. And other verses, I don't want to go into in this issue. After the Prophet Muhammad and the infallible Imams, we see many scholars and interpreters during the history of Islam has been reading different books by the name of Tafsir. We have hundreds of books of Tafsir in Islam from Sunni point of view and from Shia point of view. We have many different books in this regard. And one of the books and one of those interpretations is Allama Bahabadi's interpretations of the Quran. So, the first question which comes into our mind after looking at these interpretations and these books is that all these books has one and unique methods, or no, they have different methods in these books. Yes, when we refer to these books, we can see there are many different methods in the interpretation of the Quran. So, the methods of interpretation or interpretive method can be defined in two different categories. Or we can say we can introduce and we can define the interpretive method in two different terms. Sometimes when we see the methods of the interpretations, we mean the tendencies, we mean the approaches. Yeah? But sometimes when we say the method, we mean rules and regulations. So there are two different meanings for methods when we refer to the Quran, to the interpretation of the Quran. The first one is tendencies and approaches, and also we can say tastes of the commentator. And the second one are rules and regulations. So, in the first meaning of the method, we have different tendencies among the interpreters of the Quran. Some of them have the philosophical approaches, Some of them have theological approaches. Some of them are, can say, mystical approaches, and so forth and so on. We have different approaches among the Muslim interpreters and Quranic interpreters. So it is the first one. And the second one, which I said that the rules and regulations, when we say the method, it means that the rules and regulations, it means that there have been, for example, one of the commentators have the theological approaches, but they have a certain rule and regulation in his interpretations. For example, Fakhr Razi, in his interpretations, he has this theological approach. But when he wants to do this theological approach to the exegesis of the Quran, they have a certain rule and regulations. They have a comparative study. They compare Islam and Shi'i Islam side with the Mu'tazilite one. So it is the rules and regulation which is related and can say specified to the Fakhr Razi. Or when we, for example, the other one, like Bahrani in his book Al Burhan, we see they have a certain rule and regulation for referring to the riwayat, to the narrations and traditions. So that they have a certain rule and regulations. But they have also their approaches, their, can say, tendencies. So let me give you a very short discussion about these tendencies in tafsir, and also after each and every tendencies we go through in the Allama Bahawi's book and tafsir. There are many approaches in interpretations. The first one is the pure hadithi tendency. Some of the interpreters, when interpret the Quran, just collecting the hadiths and narrations above and under the verses. For example, when they say Iyyaka na'budu wa Iyyaka nasta'in, they just look and collect all of the narrations which comes above the Iyyaka na'budu wa Iyyaka nasta'in. It is, we call it pure hadithi tendency, pure hadithi approaches. Just collecting all the ahadiths regarding that issue, that we can say that verse. But they don't look at the authenticity of that riwayat, about the chain of that riwayat, sunnah. It is the first tendency. The second tendency is the studying hadith, and can say researching hadith tendency. They collecting hadith, and after collecting, they are also looking at the chain of hadith, the authenticity of this hadith. It is hadith sahih, hasan, also for and so on. So they want to gives us many more information about that riwayah which comes under the, we can say, verses. Allama Bahawi also has this one. When we look at the tafasir, which is written by the Allama Bahawi, we see that Allama Bahawi gives us many different riwayah regarding the verses, and after the verses also he has, a tendency to look at the chain of this hadith, the authenticity of this hadith, or so forth and so on. It is the first one, the pure hadith, the second one, the study of hadith, and the third one, the third tendency and approaches to the hadith is the literary approaches, or looking at the words and terminology of the words and the terms. So, some of the interpreters of Zamakhshari in his Kashaf, when interpret the Quran, just looking at the terms and the terminology of that terms, and the literary teaching, studying about that terms, and gives us many information about the terms and the literary, discussion about that. So it is the method of some of interpretive terms. And we see Allama Bahawadi also has this one. He has, he also look at to the terminology of the terms of the Quran. And also one of the sources which he referred in this regard is in Kashaf Zamakhshari. We see in his book many reference to the Al-Kashaf. So it is the third one. The fourth one is the mystical tendency, or Irfani tendency, or Irfani projects. I don't see anything about that in the Allama Bahawadi's work and interpretations, but also we can say in some, we can say part of his interpretation, we can find some tendency to the mystical issues, but not, we can say, very clear, is it that? So, the, we can say, mystical tendency has a long history, you know, and it is started from the 6th and 7th century, and also it has continued to the time of Muhyiddin Arabi. And in the time of Muhyiddin Arabi, it has a way, we can say, popular tendency in interpretations. But, you know, there are many different, we can say, misunderstanding in this method. For example, when they want to interpret the Quran in some guessed verses, they interpret the Prophet Moses as Aql, and the Prophet and the Pharaoh as we can say Nafs, or we can say soul. So the challenging between these two is the challenging between Aql and Nafs. You know, this is the mystical tendency, and we don't see in it in the Allama Bahawadi's interpretations. Yeah. So, also there are another approaches in this in the interpretation of the Quran, which we can call it the scientific approaches. Some of the interpreters referring to the science and knowledge, like the Islamic science, the experiential science, and so forth and so on, and wants to interpret the Quran through the science, you know. So there are the very close relationship. They want to say that there is very close relationship between the Quran and the science, and wants to interpret the Quran through the science, which exists nowadays. It is not the, you can say, the method of the Allama Bahawadi, but it is nowadays we can see in some books and some, you can say, interpreter commentary books of the Quran. So as a conclusion, let me give you a summary about the same as that, and give you a conclusion of the this can say presentation. So, as I mentioned, there are many different approaches in the commentary of the Holy Book of Quran. So, the Allama Bahawadi has all of this, we can say, the collections of these tendencies, and we can say that it is the complete ijtihadi. Complete ijtihadi, the tendency and approaches to commentary of the Quran and to interpretation of the Quran. So we see the Allama Bahawadi has the three methods of the interpretation of the Quran, tafsir al-Quran of the Quran. They refer to the Quran, to other verses for, we can say, interpret the verses. For example, when he reached to the verse "Ihdina as-sirat al-mustaqim" in his book, he referred to the other verses, أَنَعْبُدُونِي هَذَا صَرَاطُ مُسْتَقِيمٍ, and defining the verse صَرَاطُ مُسْتَقِيمٍ, what is the صَرَاطُ مُسْتَقِيمٍ, and also in, when referring and interpreting the Surah Al-Hajj and the Ikhlas, he said that قُلْ هُوَ اللَّهُ أَحَدٌ, أَحَدٌ here means something, and wants to answering and interpreting the Ahad, and he differentiates between the Ahad and Wahid, he referred to other verses, and interpreting the verse and the term by the other verses of the Qur'an. So it is the tafsir of the Qur'an, but the Qur'an he has, we can see many different occasions of the Allama Bahawadi's books. And also he has tafsir of the Qur'an and al-Rivaya and Sunnah, he gives us many narrations and ahadith regarding the verses of the Qur'an from Amir al-Mu'minin and so forth and so on. And also he has also take benefit from different hadithi books and different hadithi tafsir, for example, the tafsir Ayyashi also from the this regard. And also he look at the terms and also terminology and literary meaning of the terms of the Qur'an, and also the qara'at, and we can say the recitation of the Qur'an. He look at the recitation and different recitation of the Qur'an, and also for this regard he has referred to the Zamakhshari's book of Kashaf. Thank you. I think that's enough. It is very useful, we can say, study for me. That's I thanks dear brother Dr. Atitu for giving me this suggestion that you present something about the method of Allama Bahawadi's. I read the Allama Bahawadi's books in this regard, and I said that it is very good and very, alhamdulillah, the complete method that he has, complete all of the approaches and tendencies and methods in his book, and for giving us a very complete and clear, clarified interpretation of the Quran. Thank you again. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ahsan Al-Zadim Al-Sareen, for your very informative presentation. We are going to shift to Dr. Mohammed Ikia, but first of all, I should say that there was a mistake in in the poster, as well as in my invitation to the discussion, because there was a mistake in the title written. For it was for Dr. Mohammed Ikia. The topic that she is going to explain is the scientific diplomacy in the Safavid era, a case of study of Allama Bahawadi. So I should say sorry for this mistake, and we are going to start with Dr. Mohammed Ikia and take from the points that she's going to mention here. Please start, Doctor.
Hello.
Walaikum Assalam. Please start your discussion.
Do you have me?
Yes, you are your rest. Please start.
Thank you so much.
Welcome.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful, helpful to everyone. I appreciate the history of the Congress of Amir al-Bahawadi. And thanks for this opportunity. I'm given to my paper with the title of Scientific Diplomacy in the Safavid Era, a case study on Allama Bahawadi. In this presentation, my claim is that in the 17th century, the Ottoman Empire and the Safavid Empire were engaged in a bitter rivalry. This rivalry extended to the religious sphere, with the Sunni Sheikh of Islam of Istanbul and the Shiite scholars of Islam. They armed against each other. In contrast to this conflict, there was a valuable trend in Najaf that wanted to keep Shia Islam out of political disputes and transmit Shia traditions related to Sunni thought, which had been presented by the school of Baghdad, Hele, and Jalalabad to future generations. Mullah Abdullah Bahwadi, one of the scholars of Najaf, came on in realizing this important role of Najaf. He was successful in both creating scientific diplomatic trends that helped keep Najaf out of the Ottoman and Safavid rivalry and in transmitting pre-Isfahan scholastic thought to Shia Islam after Islam. And my presentation has three parts. One, I will describe the political condition of Bahá'í era, and then I'm going to speak about the role of scholars in the conflict between Safavids and Ottomans. And finally, I will talk about the role of Adam and Muhammad's scientific diplomacy in this period. I start with explaining the first part. To study the social-political role of Adam and Muhammad, we need to focus on political, religious, and historical condition of society. Adam and Muhammad, early period of the Safavid Empire. The Safavid Empire was a Shiite Muslim government that ruled Iran from 1501 to 1736. At the same time, on the other hand, side of the Muslim world, we have the Ottoman. The Ottoman Empire was Sunni caliphate that controlled much of Southeast Europe, parts of West Asia and North Africa of the early 20th century. There was a conflict between the Ottoman Shaykhulislam and the Safavid ulama, which is so crucial for this presentation today. So I need to address the conflict between the Ottoman Shaykhulislam and Safavid ulama was a religious and political dispute that lasted for centuries. It was related to different religious and political ideologies of these two empires. Shaykh al-Islam was the highest religious authority in the Ottoman Empire, and in general, I can say they were responsible for upholding Sunni Islam. At least some of them used to evaluate the Safavids as heretic and their enemy. So, let's say several of them even issued fatwas against Safavids and calling for the destruction of Safavid Empire. Considering your rival as enemy was not intended to Ottoman Shaykhul Islam. And the Safavid ulama too, I mean some of them, used to view the Ottoman Empire like the present Shiite state and ask for its destruction. They supported the spread of Shiism, Ottoman history, and they encouraged Shiite rebellion against Ottoman rule. The conflict between these two empires led to a number of wars and battles. And in 1714, the Ottoman army defeated the Safavid army at the Battle of Khalra. This victory gave the Ottomans control over much of Eastern Anatolia and even further weakened the Safavids. The conflict also led to a number of religious parties. There are historical reports that some of Shaykhul Islam persecuted Shiites in Ottoman Empire, and also the Safavids ulama persecuted Sunnis in their empire as well. In fact, the conflict between these two, Iranian Shaykhul Islam and Safavid ulama, was a complex and multifaceted feud. Let's summarize That's what I said about the conflict in the three main categories. The first political difference. These empires had different political orientations. This difference in political ideology led to a number of harsh clashes over territory and power. The second, geopolitical rivalry. The two empires were rivals for power in the Middle East. They competed for control over trade routes, resources, and influence. This competitiveness led to a number of wars and conflicts. And the third, last but not the least, it's about religious difference. These two had different religious ideologies. This difference in religious ideology led to a number of theological disputes in the approach to partition life, jurisprudence, and theology. So, considering these three factors, one can say that both religious colors of sacrifice and offering had such a major position at the heart of this conflict between these two great states. In fact, the religious scholars of the two empires used their appropriate and difference to spread out propaganda and hatred everywhere again. They often portrayed the other side as heretic and apostate. Based on historical evidence, we can say that they used to accuse the other side of distorting Islam and of being the threat to their own religious communication. To provide you with a clear example of this, one famous and great Ottoman people named Al-Shubh. He should have passed on in 1515 calling for extermination of the Catholics. He argued that the Catholics were heretics who were trying to overthrow the Sunni Caliphate. And as you know, just then, he was one of among the several ancestors from like Abdullah and Abbas. Of course, I can say it was not just act of shamelessness, but ulama who did the same as well. If past Catholics and religious scholars of the Sufis, that was the United Ottomans, and they accused the Ottomans of being infidels who were persecuting sheep. This propaganda contributed to the climate of fear and competition between the two empires. And also, as it's clear, it embraced the religious fight. As you know, sometimes it's quite good. Let's focus on the Safavid side and speak about the role of Shia scholars that they played in the temple. At the time of Safavid Empire, Shia scholars gave the legitimacy to the Shah of Iran. The Shia religious scholars occupied a particularly vital position in the empire. In fact, they played most an important role both politically and socially. They were against the Ottomans and the Sunni Shiites, both religiously and ideologically. It claims more accurately in our mind that during this period of Sunni, there were many cultures who have thought existed among Shiite scholars, i.e., the Athenians and Muslims. And this major field of thought further existed in Quran. and during this couple of things, they had an important position in government too. As you know, these people against policy. That's what is presented in the traditional couple. That was based on emphasizing on the importance of the pressure of hadith for the sake of Rahman and Muhammad among them. They were generally opposed to any form of rational inquiry for innovation in the process of getting the religious facts or values. For them, referring to Ahadith was itself and jurisprudential methodology was not divided or even limited. But also, on the other hand, they were presenting a rational school of thought. They emphasized on the importance of reason, logic, and interpretation in religious studies. Usulis were traditionally so open and welcoming to receive ideas and argumentation from Sunni. Usulis was part of a era in the city of Istanbul where strict priestly with whatever had something written to the Sunnis. So, we can say the importance of this issue so we can understand if we pay attention to the fact that Muslims could gain influence during the Safavid period. They, as well as actually, they often cooperated with the Safavid state and could occupy a variety of governmental positions. And you know, these two were engaged in battle too. So, when we are speaking of the one at Istanbul, we are in a big battle. And this conflict turned to Najaf. And when we are speaking about Najaf, we can refer to the battlefield of this. The battle of two empires. The Ottoman Safavid rivalry for extending their dominance over the body of Christ, Najaf and Karbala, they become one of major actors in the conflict between these two empires. Both empires wanted to gain control of the shrine. For the Ottomans, it means having upper hands over the Waribashkir Empire, I mean the Safavids. And for Safavids, it means solidifying the religious authority and legitimacy. Let us speak more specifically about the reason. Illustrated by the Ottomans and Safavids, they're so eager to control their holy shrine. Because of this reason, the religious Ottomans and Safavids, they're both competing for religious authority in the modern world. If you could give any of them the major advantage over the other one in this competition. And the Holy Shrine was located in Iraq, which was the strategically important region, control of Iraq, which given the empire that controls with a major advantage in regional politics and at the end, economic benefits. The Holy Shrine is a very important pilgrimage destination for sheep from all over the world. Control of the shrine could bring economic benefits for the empire that had them as the part of its currency. I did not expect that the biography had a significant impact on the vision. And even one can shape the religious and political landscape of modern today Iraq. I understand the great contribution made by Bethlehem. We need to focus on this role during the hardest possible time of this conflict. Then, finally, the Ottoman conquered Najaf. It was a major blow to the Fatahites, and it also posed a threat to Shia character of the city. Despite the conquest of Ottoman, not only Bahabadi managed to keep staying in Najaf, but also preserve position as the administrator of the shrine under the authority of Ottoman. This was a remarkable achievement, given the tense political and religious climate of the time. Now I'm going to speak about the rule of Bahabadi. In the Safavid-Ottoman conflict, Bahabadi's role in Safavid-Ottoman conflict can be divided into two main things. First, as an actor, Bahabadi, as a leading father of Najaf, played a key role in creating scientific diplomatic friends that helped Najaf out of the Ottoman Safavid rivalry. Second, as a thinker, Mullah was successful helping the Transistic Prince Oman grasp the south of Shia to afterwards. This is speak about his diplomatic ability as an actor. In fact, he performed such a delicate balancing act of scientific diplomacy. And this illustrates some aspects of it. As I mentioned before, Bahabadi was a key figure in the city of Najaf. He was appointed as the administrator of the Holy Shrine of Imam Ali under the authority of Shah Abbas. And when the city became a part of the Ottoman Empire, it was Bahabadi who wanted its house of the battle and not to be a partisan. But policy of Bahabadi, he helped to ensure that the shrine of Mahali remained a center of Shia learning and scholarship as well. It means how the independence of the Shia community was the most important matter to me. And in fact, it was Bahabadi that helped the Shia community of the Najaf to provide the support of the Ottoman conflict and even continue to thrive for centuries after that. That proved Bahabadi's diplomatic talent and skillfulness. In fact, that he was able to build trust with the Ottoman authorities while also maintaining his commitment to Shia community and Iran as its center. Imagine the Bahabadi convinced the Ottoman to allow him to serve the administrator of the tribe. And I don't need to mention that he also could prevent the shrine from being damaged or destroyed during the Ottoman conquest. Bahabadi's success existed in his public speaking to spread the success of the democracy and Shia division. And this active secret activity of a shrine at the site of the pillar of the Shiate and practice. This
lecture. It was very useful for us, but you know, sorry for the low quality of the voice and audio. I hope that the brothers can make try to make it and it can be heard easily from the audience. You are going to be referring to later, inshallah. So we've finished the presentations. If there's a question, we can ask the audience to ask their questions or send their notes. But first of all, I'd like to say that as a conclusion to Dr. Islami's presentation, he mentioned some points that were very important and useful, but to make it clear, to come a little faster to forward, to make a good conclusion, he tried to mention some of the methods at that time, top down and up down, and the moral theories at that era, which was important, and the different views and ideas in this case, and the principles that could be mentioned here. And also he pointed out to some of the scholars, no matter from the Eastern Western, such as William Franken, and the hypothesis that either it is can be objective or not. And also we have some of the issues in the details, for example, the point that you mentioned about the natural costs and also other aspects and evidences for the moral problems and issues that can discussed here. But right now we open the discussion for the ones who are going to go to details to say something more and add the comments. So at the end of the discussion we can make open for the audience. And also we have some other understanding of the, for instance, the hukama and ulama Muslim scholars talk about the moral reasoning and some of the sana of Khams, and in particular he mentioned some of the points mentioned here. And late and after that we shifted to Dr. Ali Zada. He mentioned also very useful points in this regard, and also about different approaches in exegesis in Tafsir of Quran, that there are different groups. Some of the scholars are trying to have a taste of akhlaqi or funny other schools of thought that are trying to work on tafsir. And also, for instance, you point out mentioned Fakhr Razi and also other scholars in this case, and the methods that some of them are hadithi, some of them are based on hadith studies, or maybe can say at the end literature that, for instance, Zamakhshari and also other scholars mentioned. And also the impact of these scholars on Bahá'u'lláh and his approach, following the success of the previous scholars in ancient times. So you mentioned and added the Irfani approach and also other ways that could be very useful for us, and also we can elaborate ourselves this understanding and thoughts. And also, for instance, in tafsir, that we have different approaches. Sometimes we can explain Quran by Quran, referring to Quran. Also, we have hadith in this case that we can do that in parallel to help to take benefit from Quran, also from hadith. And then we shifted to Dr. Muhammad Kia. Although the voice was not so good, but we could understand some points from the presentation. She mentioned again, I should confess that there was a mistake in the title, and I said Khosr, what we rectified it, and we said that the point that she's going to mention is about the Safavid emperor and the diplomacy of Bahá'u'lláh in this case, that he played a great role in you can say reconciliation. We had in the first Ottoman school, the first session, we discussed about these points, and right now she upgraded our information in this case, and the impact of Ottoman Empire and Safavid Empire and the role of Alam Bahá'u'lláh in this case, and his attitude to reconcile these schools of thought, or maybe you can say these dynasties. And later on she mentioned or pointed out to his approach along Bahá'u'lláh, and the role of ulama and Sheikh al-Islam in Safavid era and in Ottoman Empire and their conflict, and you know the reconciliation could be happening this between. And also we have different schools of thought, Isfahan, Istanbul, Najaf. Also you mentioned and point out the, for instance, the Najaf and Karbala, and also the the impact of this scholar to make it smooth, to move smoothly without problem. And also we are in debt to our great scholars. So I think that this presentation and this session was very informative, very positive for all of us. I hope that this program will continue, and thank you for brothers and sisters who attend this session. And this is our duty to be thankful to those who have helped us. There's a narration from Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam in which he says, "Man lam yashkur al-mun'im min al-makhluqin lam yashkur Allah 'azza wa jalla." Someone who is not really thankful to the ones who have provided him with blessings, he won't be able to be thankful to Allah Almighty as well. So our special thank to the ones who organized this presentation, this program and conference. First of all, from the secretary of the Allama Bahawad Yazdi International Conference, in which was in partnership with the Islamic Sciences and Culture Academy and in association with the Institute for Humanities and Cultural Studies. It was our second session, and we are open to hear your notes. But if there's anything we can add, otherwise we can. We have a note? Okay, thank you very much. Recite Salat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Thank you.